see any faces as we walked through the crowd, because I wasn't very tall.
My grandmother used to sing that. She used to hum it as she dusted her house. I'd be dusting with her.
So I invited her for Thanksgiving dinner. And what do you think she did? She came!
It's time for the Apple Seed, filled with stories for you and your family. All kinds of tales from all kinds of tellers. I'm Sam Payne, and I'm thrilled to be with you for a special episode of the Apple Seed in celebration of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. I was in ninth grade when the government established a holiday to celebrate the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. Even then, the naming of the holiday revealed some of the distance the country had yet to travel in acknowledging the work of Dr. King with a national holiday. All the time I was going to school, the holiday was called Human Rights Day in my state. It wasn't until I was in college that the holiday was officially named for Martin Luther King Jr. We're thinking about Dr. King's work today and the long and arduous fight for civil rights, and on this special episode of The Appleseed, we'll bring you stories from some of our favorite storytellers that not only have something to say about Dr. King and other civil rights heroes, but also have something to say about living together as human beings in peace and respect, even when we're different from each other. We'll hear from Charlotte Blake Alston today, and Diane Furlatt, and Kate Dudding, and we'll also hear from the Broadway and television actor Charles Holt, who some time ago created a one-man performance that featured not only speeches from Martin Luther King, but also the songs associated with the civil rights movement. The performance was called Martin and Music, and we'll begin with one of those songs. We'll have Mr. Holt introduce it. He visited us in the studio during a time when we could all get together and told us about what some of these songs meant to him. Here's Charles Holt to set up a performance of I Shall Not Be Moved here on the Appleseed.
My grandmother used to sing that. She used to hum it as she dusted her house. I'd be dusting with her. And I'd say, Granny, what you singing? She said, oh, it's an old, old song. And they used to sing it when they marched. And she didn't give much, you know, indication to where it all began, but the words tell the story.
Sure.
In the beginning was the movement, and in the beginning was the music.
I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved, just like a tree that's planted by the waters. I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved. I shall not be moved, just like a tree that's planted by the waters. I shall not be moved.
I shall not be moved. Performed by actor Charles Holt here in the Appleseed Studio. There are a lot of ways to become acquainted with the work of Martin Luther King Jr., and there are storytellers like Charlotte Blake Alston who create and perform pieces that will help children remember some of the details of King's life. Charlotte Blake Alston is a longtime friend of the show and has performed her stories and music all over the globe. Here she is, acquainting a young audience with Dr. King in rhyme and story. If you could use something of a primer yourself, you'll love this piece. We're happy to bring it to you on the Appleseed.
Martin Luther King, he knew that with the love of God, he could do most anything. Martin Luther King, he said, we must be fair to all. We must let freedom ring. Well, Martin had a little friend with whom he loved to play. They'd play together all their lives, each and every day. Baseball, football, tag, hide and seek. They wrestled and they rolled around and laughed till they were weak. Well, Martin went to see his friend one bright and sunny day. The mother said, he's busy now. You have to go away. The next day he went back again. His friend did not come out. Martin could not understand what this was all about. Martin went home feeling sad. Just what is going on? My best friend will not play with me. I feel so all alone. Maybe Mom will understand. Can you explain to me? When Martin heard his mother's words, they stung worse than a bee. His mother does not want you there because your skin is brown, and white and black boys cannot play together in this town. She gave Martin a great big hug and sat him on her knee. But Martin said, "That isn't right. That isn't fair to me. I'm a good and honest friend. I do not cheat or lie. When I grow up, I'm going to change these things. At least I'll try." Martin Luther King. He knew that with the love of God, he could do most anything. Martin Luther King. He said we must be fair to all. We must let freedom ring. While Martin studied hard in school, he did his very best. And he was just a little more determined than the rest. He went to college at 15. He gave it all he had. Then he went to learn to be a preacher like his dad. When Martin spoke to people, he gave them such a lift that people used to think that God gave him that special gift. Some people came and said, "We need a preacher for our church. If you could be our minister, then we could end our search." Martin felt so good inside, he thought that he would burst. Now he was a minister who finally had a church. Martin loved the people, and they loved to hear him speak. And hundreds came to listen to him every single week. "The laws down here are just not fair. They're meant to keep us down. They're based on hatred, not on love. We must turn them around." Martin Luther King. He knew that with the love of God, he could do most anything. Martin Luther King. He said we must be fair to all. We must let freedom ring. Well, one day, Miss Rosa Parks had worked a long, hard day. Her feet were really hurting. How much I couldn't say. A bus pulled up. Miss Parks got on and sat down on a seat. All she wanted was to sit and soothe her tired feet. The bus got crowded, and the driver came to where she sat and said, "This white man wants to sit. Get up. Stand in the back." "I'm tired, and I won't get up. You can't treat folks this way." The driver said, "I'll call the law. You best do what I say." The people all looked at Miss Parks to see what she would say. "Call the law," Miss Rosa said, "because I won't stand up this day." Well, you know, they called the law. They put Miss Parks in jail. Some friends from her community went down and paid her bail, but they were really angry. Miss Parks was not a crook. "We've got to put a stop to this." And that was all it took. Dr. King said, "I agree. We can't let this go on. So we won't ride those buses, because that law is wrong." The people walked, they shared their cars, they did this for a year, till finally that law got changed, never to reappear. Martin Luther King. He knew that with the love of God, he could do most anything. Martin Luther King. He said, we must be fair to all. We must let freedom ring. Well, other laws were not so fair, and people fought each day, not with guns or fists, but by refusing to obey. People from all over began to lend a hand. They couldn't believe these kinds of things were happening in this land. Some were beaten. Some were killed. Some were thrown in jail. They sang to keep their courage up. They knew they would not fail. Then one day in Washington, thousands gathered round to hear King tell about his dream. He said, "We won't bow down. I have a dream," Dr. King said, "that one day in this land, black and white will all be free and we'll walk hand in hand." Martin Luther King. He knew that with the love of God, he could do most anything. Martin Luther King. He said, we must be fair to all. We must let freedom ring. He went to Memphis, Tennessee to help the people there. Martin and his helpers went because they really cared. They went out on a balcony and thought of the day ahead. They heard a shot. And when they looked, Martin was dead. Oh, what a sad time. People everywhere could not believe what happened there. Their hearts just felt so bare. "We are each a child of God," Martin used to say. "And if we work together, we can make a better day. Now it's up to us to carry on what he began. We must work hard to live in peace." But Martin knew we can.
Martin Luther King.
He knew that with the love of God, he could do most anything.
Martin Luther King.
He said we must be fair to all. We must let freedom ring.
Charlotte Blake Alston in Story and Rhyme, acquainting young audiences with the life and work of Martin Luther King Jr. We're celebrating today on a special episode of The Appleseed. There's more coming up. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to The Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to The Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on today's episode of The Appleseed, a special episode in celebration of the life and work of Martin Luther King Jr. Before the break, Charlotte Blake Alston, acquainting young audiences with the life of Dr. King in rhyme and story, and also Charles Holt with a performance of I Shall Not Be Moved. And up next, Mr. Holt recites for us from Among King's Speeches. This one has to do with an amusement park, and here's Charles Holt to talk about it.
His oldest daughter, Yolanda. Yolanda made her transition a few years ago. When she was out of school, she would always like to go to the airport with her father as he was flying out. And they would pass this amusement park called Funtown. And she had her eyes set on that roller coaster. And she would always say, Dad, I want to go to Funtown. And so it's about her wanting to go to Funtown, but more so, how does a father tell his daughter that she can't go to Funtown?
Sure.
Because she's black.
Charles Holt, television and stage actor, with an introduction to this piece of a speech by Martin Luther King Jr. Now he'll perform the words of Dr. King, recorded here in the Appleseed studio. Here's Charles Holt.
My little daughter loves to ride to the airport with me. She says to me so often, Daddy, you just go over and over and over again. And one of the ways she consoles herself in the fact that her daddy has to go away so much is to ride to the airport with me. And she can do it if she isn't in school. And on the way to the airport in Atlanta, we pass by what is known as Funtown. This is an amusement park center for children. Little children go to play, something like Disneyland, something like the very fine amusement centers across the country. And she would look over and say, Daddy, I want to go to Funtown. Well, we were passing by it in the automobile, and I could jump to another subject, but I didn't want to have to explain to my 6-year-old daughter that she couldn't go to Funtown because of the color of her skin. But the other day we were at home, and like most children, she likes to look at television. And she was looking at television, and she ran downstairs and said, Daddy, I've been telling you I want to go to Funtown. And they were just talking about Funtown on the television. And I want you to take me to Funtown. I've been all over the country talking about segregation and discrimination, and I thought I could answer most of the questions that came up, but I was speechless for this one. Speechless in this present moment. I didn't want to have to explain to her she couldn't go to Funtown because she was colored. But I said to myself, I have to face this situation once and for all. I sat down at the table. My wife was sitting across from me, and I called my little girl over, and I told her to have a seat on my knees. And I looked down into her eyes, and I said, Yolanda, we have a problem. You know, sometimes people don't do the right thing, and they are a little misguided. And they have a system where white people go certain places, and colored people go certain places. And they have Funtown like that. So they don't allow colored children to go to Funtown. But I didn't want her to develop a sense of bitterness and hatred in her heart. So I had to rush on to say, now, not all white people are like that. There are some white people right here in Atlanta and all over this country and all over the world who are right on this issue. And I could see tears flowing from her eyes. And that at that point, I said to her, Yoki, even though you can't go into Funtown, I want you to know that you are as good as anybody who goes into Funtown. And I want you to know that we are working hard every day to get Funtown open and to get many other places open. And I submit to you that in the not too distant future, Funtown and every other town will be open for all God's children, because we're going to work for it.
Charles Holt reciting some of Dr. King's words here in our studio. More from Charles later on, but in the meantime, we want to bring you a story about people getting along, even when they're different from each other. It's a family story from California storyteller Diane Ferlat about Diane and her mother-in-law. It's called You Never Know What the End Is Gonna Be. Happy to bring it to you here on the Appleseed. Here's Diane.
My ancestors, a long time ago, came from Africa. They didn't come from Europe. No, no, no. They didn't come from Asia. No, no, no. They didn't come from the Philippines, Australia, New Zealand, Hawaii, Mexico. They came from Africa. But my mother-in-law, her ancestors came from England. And when she found out I was going to marry her son, she got sick and couldn't come to the wedding. But her son told her, Mom, this is who I love. You miss the wedding and it's your loss. So she didn't come. And the relationship between her son and her mother began to change. She wouldn't call her son anymore. She wouldn't go to visit her son anymore. But her son would call his mother once or twice a week to see how she was doing. And that went on for about a year or so. And then her son went to visit her without me to see how she was doing. And that went on for about a year or so. And my husband and I decided to adopt a child, a little girl. And my husband went to see his mother again, and he brought me this time with a baby. And she was so nice. When we got to her house, she opened the door. And that was a start. She invited us in. She sat way across the room. She gave me some tea with lemon. But there was no conversation. There was questions. I understood where she was coming from. She didn't know anybody black. All she knew about black people was what she saw on the television. And back then it was power to the people and all political prisoners. The Black Panther Party. That's not me and my family. That's all she knew. But after a few more visits, pretty soon the questions wore off. And she began to talk. One-on-one, eye-to-eye, heart-to-heart. And when that happens, the wall between us began to come down. And she would hold the baby. And when she held that baby, I saw the warmth come over her face. A little spark in her eyes. And she said, oh, isn't she cute? She's so sweet. It was a wonderful thing. She was warming up. The next visit, she was holding the baby again, rocking her. I'm playing the piano. I'm helping her in the kitchen. And one time after a visit, I couldn't believe this. She tried to give me a half a hug. Well, that was better than no hug. That's a start. About maybe a year or two later, my husband and I adopted another child, a boy. He was 3.5 years old. And when she met him, she just loved him. And there we were, visiting her again. She brought gifts for the children. She was playing and laughing with the children. I was helping in the kitchen. We ate dinner together, went for a ride in the car. It was wonderful. And pretty soon, after a few more visits with my children and my husband, we were leaving the house, and she tried to give me a whole hug. And I said, "Whoa! Could she like me? She couldn't love me." I thought, I'm going to test her. So I invited her for Thanksgiving dinner. And what do you think she did? She came. She came. And to spice things up, I invited my mama and daddy. And they had never met her in life. And when my daddy walked in the house and he saw her and he found out her name was Lorraine, he walked over, picked up her hand, and he sung the whole song by Nat King Cole. "My sweet Lorraine, Lorraine." She loved my daddy, but she missed all those years knowing him, because everybody liked my daddy, who took time to get to know him. That's the kind of guy he was. He was Mr. Happy. Then I saw my mother-in-law and my mother sitting at the table talking to each other about their early childhoods. The day my mother was born was the day her mother died. And my mother-in-law, her mother was an immigrant. She had a hard time growing up in America. But they both realized they had hard times, but they made it. They survived. And they said, "But we're still here." And my mother-in-law, she realized life was too short to miss out on family, grandchildren. See, her family didn't gather at holidays. I don't understand that. Her family hardly even talked. Our family always gathered. Any reason to eat. We'd always say, "You bring the salad. I bring the ham. You bring the chicken. You bring the cake." We all came together. We would eat and eat and eat and eat and eat. Fall asleep. Wake up. Eat some more. Eat some more. That's the way it was. And no offense to anybody who's English, but my mother-in-law, she couldn't cook. Just throw things in a pot and boil it. No flavor, no seasoning. She loved my daddy's cornbread dressing. She loved those greens. She loved those candied yams. I mean, she loved that baked chicken with that long gravy. I mean, she was eating like it was the Last Supper. And every holiday after that, what do you think she was? At my house? Or my mama and daddy's house? Or we brought the food to her house? She finally came around, my mother-in-law, 8 or 9 years before she died, realizing she had family, love, and good eating on holidays, too. Very careful how you treat people, because you never know what the end's gonna be. Because my mother-in-law, when she was on her deathbed in the hospital, guess who was all around her bed? Black folk. The nurse was black. Me, my mother, my father, my brother, my two children, and her husband and son. Do you know who put lotion on her dry legs and feet? My mother. Do you know who rubbed her back and fluffed her pillow because her back was hurting her so bad? My mother. Be very careful how you treat people, especially if you don't know them, because you never know who might have to give you a cool drink of water or rub your brow. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. Was blind, but now I see. Was blind, but now I see.
Diane Farlatt with You Never Know What the End's Gonna Be, a story about people learning to get along, even when they're different from each other. As we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. Day on this special episode of The Appleseed, we've been enjoying, among the stories, thoughts and music and snatches of speeches performed by actor Charles Holt, who wrote and performed a show about Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement called Martin and Music. Here's My Living Shall Not Be in Vain, performed here in the Appleseed studio by Charles Holt. We'll let him set it up.
I think a lot of people wanted to revel in the achievements and the accomplishments of Dr. Martin Luther King, and surely being the youngest at the age of 35 to win the Nobel Peace Prize and having all kinds of awards and those types of things put on him, he wasn't so concerned with those things. He wanted people to know, at the end of the day, I wanted to make someone's life better. I wanted to create a platform for peace and nonviolence. I wanted, if anything, those accolades to get me into places so I could share this consciousness of harmony with as many people as it would allow me to engage. I want people to know that I tried to help somebody. And so the song comes out of that type of reverence for the call, and not necessarily what all of those other things, the distinguished achievements that he made that came along with it, but the call itself. If I can help somebody as I pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a word or song, if I can show somebody who is traveling wrong, then my living shall not be in vain. If I can help somebody as I pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a word or song, if I can show somebody who is traveling wrong, then my living shall not be in vain. My living shall not be in vain.
shall not be in vain. No, if I can help somebody as I pass along, then my living shall not be in vain. No, no, my living shall not be in vain. No, my living shall not be in vain. No, if I can help somebody as I pass along, then my living shall not be in vain.
Charles Holt performing My Living Shall Not Be in Vain, a song of the civil rights movement, right here in the Appleseed studio. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be back with a story from Kate Dudding, the story of another civil rights hero. I'm Sam Payne.
You're listening to the Appleseed. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back to the Appleseed. Here's Sam Payne.
It's great to have you back with us on a special episode of the Appleseed in celebration of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. You know, when it came to the ability of individuals to make a difference, the civil rights movement had no age requirement. Some of the heroes were young people. And up next, Kate Dudding, a longtime friend of the Appleseed, spends her time as a storyteller researching and presenting the stories of people who made a difference in the world around them. Here's Kate presenting the story of Ruby Bridges on the Appleseed.
Do you remember the painting by Norman Rockwell of the tiny African-American girl in a sparkling white dress and with white ribbons in her pigtails being escorted into school by four U.S. Marshals? Her name is Ruby Bridges. I'm going to tell you Ruby's story using her own words. I was a six-year-old first grader in New Orleans when Mama told me on a Sunday in November 1960, "You're going to be starting at a new school tomorrow, Ruby. There might be a lot of people outside the school, but you don't need to be afraid. I'll be with you." I wasn't happy. I thought, "I'm not going to be going to school with my friends anymore?" But I just said, as I had been taught, "Yes, ma'am." Much to my surprise and my mama's surprise, four U.S. federal marshals knocked on our front door the next morning, escorted us into a car, and drove us the five blocks to my new school. One marshal told us in the car, "Let us get out of the car first. Then you'll get out, and the four of us will surround you. We'll walk up to the door together. Just walk straight ahead and don't look back." Mama told me, "Ruby, I want you to behave yourself today and do what the marshals say." In front of the school, there were barricades and people shouting and policemen everywhere. I thought, maybe it's Mardi Gras. That's always noisy. I didn't see any faces as we walked through the crowd, because I wasn't very tall, and I was surrounded by the marshals. People yelled and threw things. I could see the school building, and it looked bigger and nicer than my old school. The policeman at the door and the crowd behind us made me think this was an important place. It must be college, I thought to myself. Mom and I sat in the principal's office all day. The marshals were outside in the main office. There was a window between the two offices. All day I watched upset white parents rush into the main office, arguing and pointing at us. We just sat and waited all day. We didn't talk to anybody. When it was 3 o'clock, the marshals walked us out of the school. The crowd outside was bigger and louder. It seemed to take a long time to get to the marshal's car. All I remember seeing is a black doll in a coffin, which frightened me more than the nasty things people screamed at us. Much later, I learned that this was the first day of court-ordered integration in New Orleans, November 14, 1960. Earlier that year, the school board had decided to comply with the court order by integrating the first grades. All African-American kindergartners had taken an entrance exam the previous spring. Surprisingly, only 6 passed the test, and only 4 of those chose to integrate a white school. I was the only one going to my new school. 3 other African-American girls attended a different elementary school in New Orleans. Daddy feared our family might be hurt. The NAACP pressured my parents to send me to that nearby school, a better one than the more distant black school that I had attended. Mama didn't think we would be harmed. She wanted me and my younger siblings to get the best education possible. Mama had grown up, then married, on a sharecropper's farm. She told me, "On the day before you were born, I carried 90 pounds of cotton on my back under the broiling sun. I wanted a better life for my children. That's why my family had moved to New Orleans, for a better life." Mama finally convinced Daddy to let me go to the white school. But they didn't explain any of this to me, just telling me that I was going to a new school. Actually, how can you explain all this to a 6-year-old? On the second day, as the marshals walked us through the crowd, people spat on us and shouted nasty things. One woman screamed at me, "I'm going to poison you. I'll find a way." She would make that same threat every morning. A young white woman met us inside the building. She smiled at me. "Good morning, Ruby Nell," she said, just like Mama, except with what I later learned was a Boston accent. "Welcome. I'm your new teacher, Mrs. Henry." She seemed nice, but I wasn't sure how to feel about her. I'd never been taught by a white teacher before. Mrs. Henry took Mama and me to her second-floor classroom. All the desks were empty, and she asked me to choose a seat. I picked one up front, and Mrs. Henry started teaching me the letters of the alphabet. I wasn't allowed to have lunch in the cafeteria or go outside for recess, so we just stayed in our room. The marshals sat outside. If I had to go to the bathroom, the marshals walked me down the hall. Mama sat in the classroom that day, but not the next. On the third morning, Mama told me, "I can't go to school with you today, Ruby. I have to work and look after your younger brothers and sister. The marshals will take good care of you, Ruby Nell. Remember, if you get afraid, say your prayers. You can pray to God anytime, anywhere. He will always hear you." That was how I started praying on the way to school. The things people yelled at me didn't seem to touch me. Prayer was my protection. After walking up the steps past the angry crowd, though, I was glad to see Mrs. Henry. She gave me a hug and sat right by my side instead of at the big teacher's desk in the front of the room. Day after day, it was just Mrs. Henry and me working on my lessons. My parents shielded me as best they could, but I knew problems had come to our family because I was going to that school. My father lost his job. The white owners of a grocery store told us not to shop there anymore. Even my grandparents in Mississippi suffered. The owner of the land they'd sharecropped for 20 years said, "Everybody knows it's your granddaughter causing trouble in New Orleans. You're going to have to move." At the same time, there were a few white families who braved the protests and kept their children in my school. But those children weren't in my class, so I didn't see them. People around the country who'd heard about me on the news sent letters and donations. A neighbor gave Daddy a job painting houses. Other folks babysat for us, watched our house to keep away troublemakers, even walked behind the marshal's cars on my way to school. My family couldn't have made it without our friends and neighbors' help. I couldn't have gotten through that year without Mrs. Henry. Sitting next to her in our classroom, just the two of us, I was able to forget about the world outside. She made school fun. We did everything together. I couldn't go out in the schoolyard for recess. So right in that room we played games, and for exercise we did jumping jacks to music. I remember her explaining integration to me and why some people were against it. It's not easy for people to change once they've gotten used to living a certain way, Mrs. Henry said. Some of them don't know any better and they're afraid. But not everybody is like that. Even though I was only six, I knew what she meant. The people I passed every morning as I walked up the school steps were full of hate. They were white, but so was my teacher, who couldn't have been more different from them. She was one of the most loving people I had ever known. The greatest lesson I learned that year in Mrs. Henry's class was the lesson of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., who tried to teach us all, never judge people by the color of their skin. Now Mrs. Henry watched me from her window as I walked into school. One morning when I got to our classroom, she said, "I was surprised to see you talking to the mob today. What were you saying to them?" "I wasn't talking to them. I was praying for them. Usually I pray in the car on the way to school, but I forgot this morning until I was in the crowd. I prayed, 'Please be with me, God, and be with these people too. Forgive them because they don't know what they're doing.'" "Ruby Nell, you are truly someone special," Mrs. Henry whispered to me as she gave me an even bigger hug than usual. I did have nightmares that year, and I lost my appetite. The child psychiatrist who visited me each week thought I was afraid that the woman who threatened to poison me every day would really do it. Maybe he was right. My appetite did return after that year was over. At the end of the year, Mrs. Henry and I finally had company. A few more white children began coming back to school. They came into our classroom once or twice. I still didn't understand racism or integration. Then one white boy refused to play with me. "I can't play with you. My mama said not to because you're black." Finally, it all made sense to me. Everything had happened because I was black. I felt a little stunned. It was all about the color of my skin. I wasn't angry with the boy. He was just obeying his mama. The next year, there were no protesters. I rushed into school and started heading up the stairs to Mrs. Henry's classroom. Another white teacher told me, "Ruby, your class is down here this year." I rushed into that room, but Mrs. Henry wasn't there. She wasn't teaching in our school anymore. I later learned that she hadn't been hired back. My class was 20 students, mostly white. My new teacher made fun of the Boston accent I had picked up from Mrs. Henry. "I know you had that northern woman for a teacher last year, but you're not saying the words right." I graduated from that elementary school and an integrated high school. I went to business school and became a travel agent working for American Express in New Orleans. I married and had four sons. I occasionally thought about 1960. I lost something that year, my childhood. As a grown woman, I watched the PBS series Eyes on the Prize about the civil rights movement. Mama had to point out that some of the old film footage was of me. I didn't even know that Norman Rockwell had painted a picture of me until I was 18. In the 1990s, I slowly began to realize that what I had done in 1960 was meaningful and important. The child psychiatrist who had visited me wrote a book about me. Because of the book, I became visible again to the public and amazing things began to happen. Mrs. Henry wrote to the publisher, and I was reunited with her after 35 years. We stay in touch and sometimes do book signings together. It's taken me a long time to own the early part of my life. For a long time, I was tempted to feel bitter about the school integration experience, not understanding why I had to go through it and go through it alone. Now I know it was meant to be that way. People are touched by the story of the black child who was so alone. I am now an author and a public speaker, often speaking to children. I tell children that black and white people can be friends. And most important, I tell children to be kind to each other. Norman Rockwell's painting of me hung just outside the Oval Office in the White House the summer of 2011. I was invited to view it with President Obama. He told me, "I think it's fair to say that if it hadn't been for you guys in the civil rights movement, I might not be here."
The story of Ruby Bridges, performed for you by Kate Dudding, who researches and presents the stories of people who made a difference. We've got time for one more storytelling adventure this hour, and this seems appropriate as we think about the work of Dr. King and his colleagues, and also as we think about the distance yet to travel in our journey toward living together in harmony. Back when we could all get in a room together, we gathered in the Appleseed studio for an evening of stories and music. Songwriter Ryan Shoup joined us to perform a song of his called "Dream Big." I introduced him. Here's a recording from that evening. My wife and I were at a museum exhibit not too long ago with our children, Leah and Sammy. The exhibit was an exhibit of Pulitzer Prize-winning photos. Now, that's right up Leah's alley. That's the kind of thing she would do for fun, right? But Sammy, you really got to drag him kicking and screaming to stuff like that. We're going to a museum to look at some photos. Yes, we are. So we went to the museum, and we were looking at all of these wonderful photos. You've seen many of them. We saw the flag being raised on Iwo Jima. We saw Babe Ruth standing in the stadium. We saw all of these wonderful photos. And after we had seen a lot of these photos, we went out into the kind of the lobby of the museum, and my son and I sat down on a bench, and I said to him, "Are there any of these photos that are reaching you?" And he said, "Well, are there any of these photos that are reaching you?" And I said, yeah, there are. And I told him about the photo that I had loved most in the exhibit, a photo taken from a train. The photographer is riding on a train, and he has captured a shot of a little boy and a little girl who have just burst from the foliage that the train is rushing along next to. They've burst from the foliage on the back of a horse. And this horse is riding along next to the train, and the children have their arms outstretched, and they're smiling at the people on the train. And the photographer caught a picture right then. And it's the most beautiful picture. I can hardly think about it now without getting a little bit emotional. And I told my son that. And I said, "How about you? See anything you like?" And he said, "Well, it's not so much that I liked it, but he said, I can't get it out of my head." And I said, "What is it?" And he said, "It's that picture right there." And he pointed at the photo that was right across from the lobby. And it was a photo taken in Ferguson, Missouri, of a guy, a protester, picking up a can of tear gas and throwing it back at the police who had thrown it at him. Now, I don't know all of the reasons why my son was impacted by that photo, but we started to talk about some of the things that had happened in Ferguson, Missouri, in the wake of the shooting of Michael Brown. And I felt in that moment to tell my son, my 12-year-old son, about the one time that I had ever been to Ferguson. It was a couple of years ago, and I didn't even know I was going to Ferguson. I was in St. Louis and driving to a storytelling concert. I was going to hear a storyteller tell stories about folk tales about stars and planets, and I was just following my GPS. Well, when the GPS got me where I was going, I found myself outside of the Challenger Learning Center.
in Ferguson, Missouri. Now, the Challenger Learning Centers, I don't know if you know about these places, but they were instituted by the families of the astronauts killed in the Challenger disaster, the Space Shuttle Challenger explosion. When that happened and the world looked on in despair at that tragedy, the families of the astronauts came together and said, "We cannot allow for the word Challenger to be associated with nothing but tragedy." And they began a campaign to establish Challenger learning centers wherever they could. Now, there are dozens all over the world, and these learning centers are space shuttle simulators on the ground. They just look like schools, brick and mortar buildings. But children and their families go to these places, and they fly simulated space shuttle missions. I thought about those children in Ferguson, Missouri, who get to go to that place and have their hearts, their eyes turned to the sky, even in the midst of conflict, even in the midst of danger. And I felt to tell my son about the Challenger Learning Centers. I hope that my son winds up being the kind of person who engages in the rigorous work of deciding what's right and what he wants to fight for, and that he has the courage to do that fighting. But I also hope that my son is surrounded in his life by the people and finds himself in the places that will help him to dream big things, that he'll use his hands in the world, but that his eyes will be turned upward and that his heart will be turned outward to big dreams. I think about that story when I think about the song you're about to hear now. This is a song called Dream Big by Ryan Shoup.
Be sure to dry your eyes, 'cause better days are sure to come. And when you smile, be sure to smile wise, and don't let them know that they have won. And when you walk, walk with pride, don't show the hurt inside, because the pain will soon be gone. When you dream, dream big as the ocean blue. 'Cause when you dream, it might come true. When you dream, dream big. And when you laugh, be sure to laugh out loud, 'cause it will carry all your cares away. And when you see the beauty all around and in yourself, it will help you feel okay. And when you pray for strength to help you carry on when the troubles come your way. And when you dream, dream big as the ocean blue. When you dream, it might come true. When you dream, dream big. When you dream, dream big as the ocean blue. 'Cause when you dream, it might come true. When you dream, dream big. train bed.
Ryan Shoup with Dream Big here on the Appleseed. It's been a pleasure to have you with us in celebration today of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It's been a pleasure for us to hear from Kate Dudding with the story of Ruby Bridges, Diane Ferlat with the story of getting to know and love her mother-in-law, even though they're different from each other, Charlotte Blake Alston with a summary of the life of Martin Luther King Jr. in story and rhyme for young people, and actor Charles Holt, the performer behind Martin and Music, a tribute to the civil rights movement. Thanks for joining us for a special episode of The Appleseed today. Find us online at byuradio.org/appleseed or Google The Appleseed Podcast and subscribe for something new just about every day on the show. Today's episode was created with the help of assistant producer Ashley Zollinger. Our senior producer is Jeff Simpson. I'm Sam Payne. It's always a pleasure to have you with us. And of course, you can find an archive of all of the episodes of The Appleseed online at our website, byuradio.org/appleseed. And there are thousands of stories there for your listening pleasure anytime you like. We love to hear from you. You can reach out to us at theappleseed@byu.edu. Again, that's theappleseed@byu.edu. We always hope that the stories that we bring you here on the show spark thoughts and memories for you that you can share with the people that you love. The show is a production of BYU Radio, and we look forward to seeing you again on The Appleseed.
Thanks for joining us for an hour of stories, music, and conversation made for you and your family and brought to you by The Appleseed. The show is a production of BYU Radio. We'll see you next time.